Hello! Welcome to the Rotten Horror Picture Show, the horror movie podcast where we talk about films off the Rotten Tomatoes 200 Best Horror Movies of All Time list. My name is Clay. With me is Amanda. How you doing, Amanda?
I'm good. I've lit my hand of glory. I'm ready to make my appointment with the Wicker Man.
Excellent. It's hard to get in there. He's booked up solid. Yeah. Especially in May.
Yeah, he's real busy.
Yes. We are, of course, talking about The Wicker Man from 1973 as part of our season of remakes and reboots. This is the original. If you'd like to hear us talk about the remake and all the bees therein, you can head over to...
We're going to name each bee.
Each bee.
And we're going to talk about its likes and dislikes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You'll be surprised which one likes chocolate. if you'd like to follow us as we do the remake, you can head over to patreon.com/thepenskyfile and listen to all the other remakes we've done up to this point. But today, we are talking about the one, the only, the original, The Wicker Man, number 81 on our list with a 91% Rotten Tomatoes score, 82% audience score. I know that you have seen this before.
Yes.
So why don't you tell us all your history with The Wicker Man? El hombre de...
Wicker?
Wicker. That's one of my favorite things is when in movies and stuff when people talk in a different language and then there's no equivalent for like a name or something.
Yeah.
And so they just say it with a full American accent. Yeah.
Well, the fun thing is when people do it in real life.
That's true.
When like actually bilingual people are just
those
like,
people don't exist.
Yes, they do. My history with The Wicker Man. Funny enough, it actually starts with the remake.
Okay.
I saw the remake first.
Oh, boy.
Because it came out in what, 2006?
Yeah, somewhere in there.
So I saw that.
My dog is trying to unplug your microphone, I think. Like he's not
grabbing
happy.
Grabbing the wire.
Yeah, he was watching the movie with me today, so I think he's a fan.
Yeah, no. So I saw the remake, and I thought, this movie is dumb.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think I said that to someone. Like, oh, yeah, that movie is stupid. And they told me in high school, well, you should watch the original.
Yeah.
And I was like, there's an original.
Mm-hmm.
And then I could not find it until I think I was in college. Like, I just like couldn't, I don't know. I could not secure myself a copy. And then I saw it when I was in college and I kind of didn't get it, to be honest. Like the first time I watched it, I was like, what the fuck is this? There's just some lady slapping her own ass in a room.
You're
at
used
night.
To other people slapping ass.
Right. Yeah. It's like, you know, this is weird. And then I ended up like a couple years later watching it again. And ever since then I have been mildly obsessed with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that you came across it in high school because this was a movie I had not even heard of until I got to college.
Well, like I said, like I like the remake was out when I like think I think it was like my senior year of high school. And I think I mentioned it in front of like an adult. Do you know what I mean?
Sure,
like the remake
had
come out and I was like, oh, I saw that dumb movie with Nick Cage. It's so dumb.
Mm-hmm.
And then an adult in my life was like, well, that's not the original movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be fun when we talk about the remake because I cannot fathom what decision making went into trying to remake this movie.
Yeah.
I know that Nick Cage actually was pushing pretty hard to do it for, you know, reasons we can talk about when we talk about it, but it's just like it's in 2005. I don't know how many people knew this movie.
No. Probably not a lot.
I came to it from, excuse me. This was another one I think that was on my list when I got Netflix.
Mm.
When I, the original OG discs in the mail Netflix.
Yep.
When
the
I
red
pulled
envelopes.
Up. Yeah. When I pulled up a website with here are the best horror movies you need to see kind of thing. This was on there. And I had a teacher in college who was a, kind of turned me on to this.
Mm.
And he, I think I was telling him, he's like, yeah, I'm going to watch this. I got The Wicker Man. He was like, oh, The Wicker Man. And he kind of went into it and he's like,
yeah.
It's, he set me up for it in that he didn't tell me what any was going to happen, but he was just like, this is a movie, a different movie than you will ever have seen.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a musical. It's kind of a horror movie. It's kind of this. So I was sort of ready for something different.
Okay.
And it did not disappoint.
I can see that sort of advanced preparation being helpful because, just re-emphasizing the fact that it took me watching this a couple times before it really hit for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I finally did watch it, it immediately jumped into like my top 10.
Mm.
I mean, based on the ending alone, having no idea what was coming and then not only to get to the end of the mystery, but then to have it end the way that it does is just like, just knocks you on your ass if you don't know what's coming.
Yes.
And I also became mildly obsessed with it. I searched long and hard. There was an edition of the DVD that came in a wooden box that had the Wicker Man, an image of the Wicker Man, and the title like burned into it.
That's awesome.
And I got that eventually. And that has the theatrical cut, and it also has the extended version. Mm. And we're going to talk about this as we go, because there are technically three versions of this movie.
Yeah.
And I asked you today what version you watched, and you said, I don't know, the one that's on Tubi.
Yeah.
And the one on Tubi is the theatrical version.
I thought so. I was not sure, because aren't they all also like only 6 minutes difference or something? Like, it's not like
there's
a huge...
So the... I'm only going to be able to pull these numbers out of my ass because I saw them like earlier today. But the theatrical cut is 128 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the extended, the final cut, which is the basically if you're going to buy it, if you're going to buy it on disc, which again is kind of difficult to do. If you're going to get it now, usually you're going to get the final cut, which is somewhere in between the theatrical and the extended version.
Okay.
Probably, I guess, the most ideal version, depending on how you like your Wicker Man. And that's like, I want to say it's like 130 something, like 133, 134 minutes. And then the extended cut is like 140 minutes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's not true. I'm sorry. Change minutes to hours. So it's
it's an hour.
It's an hour. Yeah, I was like, as soon as I said that,
2-hour and 20-minute version of the Wicker Man.
No one has. That's not a movie that exists. It's an hour. The theatrical is 1 hour and 28 minutes.
Okay.
The final cut is just over 1.5 hours.
Okay.
And the extended cut is 1 hour and 40 something.
Got it. So the extended cut is probably the one you would notice.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah, like if you had watched the theatrical version before and then you went to watch it and you got the extended cut, you'd be like, wait a minute, well, there's a bunch in this that I don't remember.
You will notice either way because I don't know when else to jump into this, but the theatrical cut starts with the corn rig song and the plane landing.
Yes.
So the final cut has all of the church stuff at the beginning before that. And then the extended cut has an even longer sequence that includes the church stuff.
Right.
And also Howie driving in a police car with his partner talking about stuff. And you see him get the letter that has Rowan in it. And it's all stuff that once you see it, you go, oh, yeah, no, they should have cut this stuff out. But there's a really interesting story as to why it's so truncated, which we will get to later. But anyway.
All right.
We're going to take a quick break, play the trailer for you, and talk about The Wicker Man. Also, fantastic Iron Maiden song. Iron Maiden, when they had their comeback album with Bruce Dickinson, the first song on the album was The Wicker Man. And that tour, I don't know how familiar you are with Iron Maiden and their stage show.
Not very.
So, do you know Eddie, the kind of mascot, the kind of zombie-faced mascot?
Yes.
So, every album, he's dressed up as something, right?
Yeah.
So on the tour, they turned Eddie into a giant Wicker Man.
That's awesome.
That Bruce Dickinson would come out from the middle of.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was really cool. It's the one Iron Maiden t-shirt that I've really wanted that I couldn't get is the Wicker Man Iron Maiden t-shirt. But
that's great.
You know, some people just can't realize their dreams. But we'll take a quick break. Come right back.
I have come here from the mainland to investigate the disappearance of a young girl. Bruin Morrison. That's her name? You know her?
No, never seen her before.
You suspect foul play?
I suspect murder.
We don't commit murder up here. We're a deeply religious people.
Where is Rowan Morrison?
It's the thing inside you, burn and thunder, Lord. Fire season, fire season, make the baby grow.
You wouldn't want to be around here, our lady. Not the way you feel.
Where is Rowan Morrison?
Fire season, fire season,
it is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
Hail the Queen of the May!
Hail the Queen of the May!
Oh God!
You simply never understand the true nature of sacrifice.
Take the flame inside you, burn and burn delay. Fire seed and fire feed and make the baby stay.
Okay, The Wicker Man. Directed by Robin Hardy, written by Anthony Schaefer. I didn't mean to say that like a Swedish person, but yeah, I was trying to make a decision in the moment because it's two Fs, so it's either Schaefer or it is Schaefer. I think it's Schaefer.
It's probably Schaefer.
Starring Edward Woodward, Diane Cilento, again, not Spanish. She's Australian, I think. Britt Eklund. Interesting bit of trivia. Britt Eklund, who plays the landlord's daughter.
Willow.
She's Swedish.
Uh-huh.
And she's dubbed.
Yes.
By an actress named Annie Ross, who, this probably won't mean anything to you, but I perked up when I saw who Annie Ross was. She's the evil hench person in Superman 3 who gets sucked into the machine at the end. And comes out as this weird, like, cyborg monster.
I gotta tell you, I don't even know if I've ever seen that movie.
I gotta tell you that this moment is, like, top five scariest things I'd ever seen in a movie when I was a kid.
Oh.
Like this and Large Marge from Pee-wee.
Okay.
Horrifying.
All right.
Anyway, so that's Annie Ross.
Cool.
Lindsay Kemp, a whole bunch of island locals, my number one Hammer horror crush, Ingrid Pitt, and Christopher Lee as Lord Summer Isle.
I thought you were going to say Christopher Lee was your number one Hammer horror crush.
Yeah, number two. No, Ingrid Pitt's pretty amazing. She did she had an incredible run of like four movies,
mm-hmm.
and then just did a bunch of other stuff that I don't know if anybody ever really saw.
Mm.
But she's like, when people talk about the Hammer girls, she's like one of the first two they mention.
Yeah.
She's also in a great movie called Where Eagles Dare, which is a World War II movie with Clint Eastwood and Richard Burton.
Oh, damn.
Very cool.
Nice.
Crazy life, this one, too. She and her mother, she's Polish.
Okay.
She and her mother were both in a concentration camp during World War II.
Holy shit.
Which they then escaped.
Holy shit.
Yeah, and then she ended up marrying an American GI in the early 50s. And yeah.
She's wow.
A really interesting life.
All right.
Anyway, Amanda, what happens in The Wicker Man?
Sergeant Neil Howie arrives on the small Scottish island of Summer Isle to investigate the report of a missing child. A conservative Christian, the policeman observes the residents' frivolous sexual displays and strange pagan rituals, particularly the temptations of Willow, daughter of the island magistrate. Well, that's not true.
She's yeah, that is
the
not
landlord's
true.
Daughter. Yeah.
The landlord's daughter.
The more Sergeant Howie learns about the Islander's strange practices, the closer he gets to tracking down the missing child.
Mm-hmm. Sort of.
Yeah, more or less.
I mean, technically, he does find her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. Gotta give credit where credit's due, which we can fight about later. Well, Clay, some things you'll find in The Wicker Man include the
ducks,
green
ducks, geese, yeah. Some sort of goat.
A cow, definitely a cow, inside The Wicker Man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Green Man Inn.
Yes, the Green Man, which is a bit of English folklore tacked into... Well, the whole movie is English folklore.
Yes.
But the Green Man is a folklore figure and motif with diverse interpretations ranging from a pagan nature deity to a symbol of rebirth and environmentalism.
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah, I think he's kind of represented in that sort of Sun. I don't know if it's the same thing.
No.
Is that Nuada?
Yes.
Okay, so there's the Green Man. He's a, if you want to learn more about the Green Man, watch Alex Garland's Men.
Mm.
Very central to that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And after you watch it, come talk to me because I got to talk to somebody about that movie because it's fucking weird.
That one's high on my list of things I need to see. So
maybe we'll use it as a wild card.
Yeah, I'm down for it.
Yeah.
Seduction via wall slapping.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting choice. Yeah. I mean, she could have done all that with her clothes on.
I would it have been as seductive?
I don't know. He can't see it.
Doesn't seem to matter.
Yeah.
The wall slapping then must be the thing that really gets to him, right? I don't know. Yeah. He can't see her. He can probably barely hear her through the walls.
He's probably thinking that could be her butt on the wall. Who's to say what she's
slapping?
He's
never seen a human woman's butt.
That's
so
true.
He doesn't know.
Could only imagine.
Yeah.
I've heard some of them can clap without their hands.
Dovetailing nicely into the next thing you'll find.
Mm-hmm.
Horny drinking songs / horny songs in general.
Every song in this movie is like a horny sea shanty, and it's great.
It's more like a horny working in the fields on the farm.
Yeah, I'm sure that there is a title for the style of song, but it's very dirty limerick adjacent.
Yes. It's like a hippie horny hippie limericks.
Yeah. The one that obviously the landlord's daughter is pretty clear.
Mm-hmm.
The one that took me a number of watches to really parse out is the one that Summer Isle and the
one about the kettle.
Yeah.
And the tinker.
Yeah. It actually wasn't until I got the soundtrack that I could hear all the lyrics and I was like, oh
yeah.
I get it.
Yeah, she's showing her kettle.
Yes.
Yeah. A classroom full of despicable little liars.
Yeah, that's all classrooms.
That's fair. Public park orgy.
Yeah, does it count as an orgy if you're just kind of like spread out like that? Or is it just like a bunch of people happen to have sex in the same place? Like, what is the parameters? You know, you've been to one.
I think it counts as an orgy if everyone has gone there on purpose.
Okay.
You know, mm-hmm. like, oh, this is the area where we all get together and have sex.
I see.
That's an orgy.
Yeah.
Right?
I feel bad for the woman who's
like crying on
naked
the,
on the tombstone.
Yeah, I feel bad for her too. Like, oh man, that's just sad. Penis topiary.
Yeah, I didn't catch the penis topiary.
I don't know how you could
you
have
came
missed
in
it.
Screaming about it, saying, I can't believe this penis topiary.
Yeah, I need to make one. I have a community. Well, yeah, I have a community garden. Shape a plant into a penis topiary, get fined by the city, it'll be great.
Yeah.
Beachside furry convention.
Yeah, great masks.
I love the masks in this.
Yeah, very creepy.
They're so good.
I was trying to think, this can't be the first movie to feature creepy animal masks like that, right? Like, that's gotta go back further than this.
It probably does. Maybe
this is the
not...
first one I think of, but
yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's something. A man animal, a man woman, and a man fool.
Now you get yourself an orgy, my friend.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's my kind of party. The salmon of knowledge.
That's my costume.
Yeah. The ejaculation of serpents.
Yeah, which is either the best or the worst heavy metal band name.
I mean, it is the one that will get you banned from the most venues.
That's true.
Yeah.
So I guess that immediately makes it the best.
Best. Yeah. Yeah. The ultimate barbecue.
Yeah. I
put everything in the fire all at once.
Yeah, it's like a barbecue turducken kind of.
That's what it should have been. I revise the things you'll find. It is now officially a barbecue turducken.
Manducken. Yeah, manducken, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they're all stuffed in. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did find myself thinking today, I bet that smells great. I was going back and forth. I was like, does that smell really good?
I don't know.
Or does it smell awful?
Because I mean, like, if they're just burning hay,
burning wood is that's a solid smell.
Is it actually wicker though?
I don't know.
Right, because I don't think burning wicker smells very good.
Probably not.
Anyway, we got one more thing you'll find, and we can fight about this one. An actually good cop plot.
Okay, I understand what you're saying. However, I'm going to say this doesn't count as a cop plot, because if the central character is a cop, then the cop plot is just the plot. And what the cop plot that I don't like are usually the peripheral cop plots, where they're only there for expository purposes.
Okay.
Whereas this one is, this is just a mystery with a cop at the center, you know?
I don't know. I feel like you're splitting hairs a little bit, but.
I mean, you're not wrong that it is a plot that involves a cop.
Well, but here's the thing. I think he's actually a pretty good cop.
Yes.
I'm just surprised. Usually when there's cop plot, all the cops are not good at being cops.
I will accept this in a child murderer or child murderer type situation where it's like good
cop plot. Actually good cop plot.
Yes, a plot featuring a good cop, sure.
Yes. All right. Consensus reached. We can move on with the conversation.
Okay. The Wicker Man, 1973. This movie was made because Anthony Schaefer and Robin Hardy wanted to make a horror movie that was a little smarter and more interesting than the usual stuff. So they started digging into all the good pagan history of the English Isles and tapped into something pretty interesting. This is the last of the big three British folk horror trio, which includes Witchfinder General in 1968, Blood on Satan's Claw in 1971, and of course, The Wicker Man in 1973. I legitimately don't know how to start talking about this. So if you have an in that you would like to dig into first, please, by all means.
I don't know if this is like the place to start. But I think it's easiest to begin with Sergeant Howie.
Sure.
Right?
Yep.
He is our central figure. He is kind of our point of view character for this whole movie.
Pretty explicitly, actually.
Yeah. So Sergeant Howie arrives in a strange place. He's sort of like the reverse of a giallo girl.
Yeah, kind of.
Do you know what I mean? He's this very formal and staid, like upright figure who has come to this seemingly idyllic place. And where I think one of the first themes you get right away in this movie is the idea of authority.
Yes.
And who has authority and what does that actually mean?
Well, you know, the thing that stood out to me immediately this time was I've probably seen this movie 25 times. And so I'm keying into different stuff as I'm this time as I'm watching it. And I found myself thinking about how much stuff is more or less left unsaid as far as that goes, and how much of the setup and stuff is very interesting. Because I found immediately, I was like, this is a really interesting setup where you've got Summer Isle, the place, which is
not the man,
which is still, which is far enough away. It's an island that it's kind of unknown.
Yes.
And doing its own thing, but it's still under the jurisdiction of Scottish law. So you can send a cop there.
Yes, but you have to send him on a plane.
Right.
Yeah. He has to be a cop who knows how to fly his own plane.
Right.
Which I think is kind of hilarious that they find the one specific cop they need to come and he happens to know how to fly.
I will say at the top here, this movie, if you are along for the ride, is fantastic.
Yes.
But the second you start trying to figure out all of the things that would have had to have occurred to get to the point where this ends, you will go cross-eyed.
Yes.
So it's better not to think about it. We can talk about it a bit later if we want to, but it's, that being one of them.
Yeah. But I do, I think also, you know, this movie was made right at a time, a point in time where there was enough technology that made the world feel so much smaller, but places like this could still exist.
Right.
Where it is this small community, it's on an island, they don't seem to have, you know, like much in terms of phone service and contact with the mainland. They're still fairly cut off. So it is plausible that you could show up at this place. And, you know, when Howie shows up, he's not aware that he's going to an island full of pagans.
Right.
He thinks he's just going to an island to search for a missing little girl.
Right.
Like, he has no idea what he's walking into. And they don't have to respect him. Mm-hmm. Like, they're removed enough from the normal world that they can all kind of humor him a little bit and sort of laugh at him behind his back in a way that probably doesn't happen to him much back home.
Yeah. Although maybe it does, because he seems pretty stuck up.
Yeah. He is very, very humorless and no fun whatsoever. And I love that first scene when he's landed the plane and he's yelling at them through the bullhorn for the dinghy. And they finally come and they bring him. And it's just this like group of old timers. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't know what the Scottish Island version of shit kickers is, but like, this is it.
That's pretty much it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like a bunch of old guys in cozy looking sweaters. And they all just sort of give him like a very bland, like, "Mom, I don't know her. Not one of ours. Doesn't belong here." Mm-hmm. Kind of intro. And it's funny because he's kind of meeting up with the population you would expect to be the most aligned with him.
Mm-hmm.
Like older men in the community, you would expect them to be most like responsive to the idea of like a government official or an authority figure coming in. And like right away, you can tell they're just sort of like, "Eh, yeah, no, whatever." They kind of like smirk at each other behind his back.
Yeah.
And I just love that as an immediate setup for what Howie has gotten. Like, you immediately get so much about his attitude and the island's attitude in response.
Yeah, because he comes in immediately. You get the sense that he thinks he knows everything.
Yeah, and he thinks he's better than these people.
Yeah.
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 He comes in with this air of superiority.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think superiority and authority, as you're saying, are two big key elements.
Mm-hmm.
It because, you know, not to jump to the end, but the thing that I found really interesting this time was how Howie and Summer Isle present as these figures of authority who both end up turning into essentially shouting, proselytizing priests at the end.
Yeah.
Like Howie goes from a uptight, you know, man of the modern era to someone screaming about you being struck down and you shall all die by the seeds of the whatever.
Yeah.
And he goes very whatever the religious version of feral is.
Yeah.
And it's I think between that and the reason that they're doing this in the first place, it really kind of it brings into question these people who are in authority and what kind of power do they actually have.
Right. Right. They're both kind of claiming a power that there's no evidence either one of them has.
Yes.
You know, Howie's authority is nominally propped up by the state. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a government imposed authority. Lord Summer Isles is by birth.
Mm-hmm.
He's Lord Summer Isle. He has an inherited title and inherited lands, and he's the lord of the island. And that kind of, because he's born into that, it's made him their de facto leader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not their leader because he's like better at farming.
Right. Yeah.
Or like more religiously knowledgeable or, you know, more holy than them. He was born into it. And they're both claiming these sort of positions of divine authority as well. Mm-hmm. Like Howie doesn't come there to proselytize, but he ends up doing so anyway. Like throughout his interactions with the villagers, he's talking more and more about his Christian faith. And Lord Summer Isle is saying, "We're going to do this sacrifice because I know that this is what's going to bring the crops back."
Yeah.
So it's interesting. Yeah, they're both kind of, they're good foils for one another. There's a good dichotomy between the two of them.
I want to get into more of that later because that was another thing I was keying into, is I started for the first time thinking about the history that Summer Isle tells him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the interesting kind of smoke screens in this movie is, since they're doing all this pagan stuff, you kind of go, "Oh, well, they've been here doing this for hundreds and hundreds of years."
Right.
That is not the case.
Mm.
It's only been two generations or three generations of people doing this.
Yeah.
And so once I was like, "Oh, that's really interesting." Mm-hmm. Because at the end, ultimately what you have at the end here is, you know, it is an irony that they are invoking these gods of nature to do something that is explicitly unnatural. because the only reason that they're there and the only reason that Summerall says his grandfather used this religion thing was to get people back into, he says he used, I wrote it down. What is it? It's, where are we here? What my grandfather started out of expediency, my father continued out of love.
Yes.
And so, like, even the origin of this whole setup is untruthful or disingenuous, rather.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's just this really interesting irony that they are putting, Summer Isle is leaning so hard into this thing that is about respecting nature to try and recreate something that was just scientifically created in the first place.
Right, because his grandfather developed these strains of crops that were not actually meant to grow where they are located geographically. And so the ecosystem isn't designed to support it. But it is also, there's sort of that like next level too, if you keep going down with the mythology, where yes, Lord Summerisle's grandfather sort of artificially resurrects the folk gods of the area. But he didn't make them up out of whole cloth.
Right.
He's not saying like, I made up this religion.
Yeah.
It's, so there's this weird, like, it was disingenuous and he sort of, it was done out of false pretenses. But does that make it any less native to the area? Do you know what I mean? Yeah, like, if that's, if you're going back to the ancient religion that was pre-Christian, then, you know, is Howie's claim that everybody should accept Jesus Christ any more legitimate than Summerisle saying,
right,
well, you should worship Nuada and Avalonau of the Orchards?
Right, yeah.
So it's interesting because, again, they're both, every time with those two characters, you think that one of them maybe has a little bit of a of an advantage or a little bit more to stand on than the other one, you sort of realize, oh, wait, no, they don't. And they keep kind of equaling back out and rebalancing.
Yeah. And, I, you know, something like the graveyard that they have is old enough that you say, okay, this probably goes, these people were probably practicing this stuff here even when they, quote unquote, weren't supposed to.
Right.
You know, like, I'm sure it was, yeah, like, the, you have the Christianity imposed on these people, and then, you know, it's, and they're probably still practicing the old stuff to a certain extent.
Yeah. I mean, if you go around, like, areas in the UK and Ireland, you still see, like, parts of folklore and folk tales and myth all over the place. Those little green man signs and pixies and stuff like that. The little devil built into like the upper corner of a building.
Yeah.
You'll find those things everywhere.
They still do the May Day parades like this.
Yeah, in a lot of areas. Places. Yeah. I've stayed in Ireland. I've stayed in the Finn McCool Inn up in...
That's the camel that sells the cigarettes? No, that's Joe Camel. I'm sorry. Finn McCool was the beer one, right?
Finn McCool was the... he defeated the giant.
Oh.
Yeah.
So he got that name after he killed the giant.
No, he was Finn McCool first.
Okay. That's pretty, that is pretty cool.
Yeah.
yeah, so it's just, I found myself really keying into that stuff this time because it is two people who claim to have the answers and the authority, both ultimately having control over nothing.
Right, and both kind of trying to manipulate others, and just one does it more successfully.
Yeah, because at the end, one of the things Howie says is like, this isn't gonna work, and next year they're coming for you.
Yeah,
and he's like, no, it's gonna work, don't worry, guy. Yeah. So like, he knows, I think Summerall knows that this is all bullshit.
See, I think that's a really interesting question.
Yeah,
because you have to remember, he's the third generation. Like, he was raised in this too.
But okay, so I think, I don't know if anybody's really gotten this deep into the Wicker Man before, but
I'm sure
there's a college class or paper, but like, I think, well, one of the things is, though, I think that brings up what you were talking about, the people who are meeting Howie at the water and their separation from Summerisle. Summerisle is clearly, he's an aristocrat, and he knows the history. So I think there's a class thing going on there as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Where I don't know if I would say Summer Isle necessarily believes any of this stuff because he understands the power of it. Like he's got the key to the power of it, whereas everybody else is sort of like they're in it because they love it and this is their religion. I think Summer Isle has more of a objective view as to what control it brings him.
I think both can be maybe kind of true. Not to totally cop out of this, but I guess I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, like I was raised Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are plenty of things in Catholicism that now I look at and I'm like, what? No, absolutely not. But part of your mind is always going to be more attached.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? You find yourself in moments of stress and need still turning to those things that you were raised with and that your parents were raised with and their parents were like. Once you've been so deep in it, even if you can step back and intellectualize things, it's still in you. It's still part of your subconscious and your makeup.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying I think Summer Isle fully believes it, but I do think it's maybe harder for him to separate than it would be for someone who was coming in purely from the outside.
Yeah. I'm also very happy that they never address any of this stuff.
Yeah, no, totally. I love that these things are ambiguous and left up for nerds on microphones to yell about.
I think there very easily could have been like the scene where Howie goes to visit Summer Isle.
Mm-hmm.
There very easily could have been a moment where Howie turns the tables and is like, well, you know that this is all garbage for the reasons you just told me.
Yeah.
Right, and it's like, oh, okay. Yeah.
Or even in that end scene you mentioned, the part of the end that you mentioned a few minutes ago where Howie yells to Summer Isle, like, when this doesn't work next year, it will be you. Mm-hmm. And Summer Isle, you know, maybe you could read a little bit of a pause, a little bit of concern in him. But there's no overt, like, there's, you know what I mean? There's no obvious moment where you see in his face him go like, oh, no, or like his hands shake or whatever. His voice doesn't waver. He still says in full conviction, it will work.
Yes.
And so, the fact that you can read it either way of, has he kind of drank his own Kool-Aid, you know?
Right,
like, is he high on his own supply or is he more just using this to manipulate people?
Yeah.
I think I love that you can argue both.
Yeah. One of the really interesting things about seeing the different versions of this is the short version is pretty short. It's less than 90 minutes.
Yep.
And the first time I saw the extended version, by the end of the extended version, and it's got this big history to it where the company, British Lion, didn't, the company got bought by another company called EMI, and the new people in charge at EMI didn't think this was worth anything. And so they first tried to get Roger Corman to distribute it, but then another company basically came in and offered more money or something. And what they ended up doing was dumping it off to a distribution company that didn't have any real experience doing this. And also in doing that, they had to cut, they cut about 15 minutes out of it, or 10 or 15 minutes out of it. And so the version that went out was this short theatrical version.
Mm.
And when you hear people talk about it, the people who made the movie, they're like, oh, they cut so much great stuff and these great scenes and blah, blah. Christopher Lee especially.
Mm.
This is like, I believe this is his favorite movie he's ever done.
I think I read that too.
He did it for no money.
Wow, really?
Yeah, when it finally got distributed in America. It was on a double bill with Don't Look Now, which is really is hilarious to me because it's like clearly two movies that this company thought was shit, but are like two fucking fantastic movies. That's like, I can't wait till we watch Don't Look Now because you're going to think back and go like, that's a heavy double bill. Anyway.
All right.
Eventually, they got a longer print. Because Corman still had a copy.
Oh, wow.
And so then once they got a longer print out there, Christopher Lee, basically on his own dime, did press in every state he could. They would allow him to do it.
Holy shit.
So he was going on talk shows and radio shows and all this kind of stuff.
Just being like, watch this movie that I'm going to get no money from because it's the best movie ever.
Yeah, like he felt he was that committed to thinking it was a great film.
He was
and
not wrong.
No, and then it eventually became like this midnight movie kind of cult classic. And so he especially talks about this stuff that got lost, and the reason that it was lost forever is because they kept all the negatives at Shepperton Studios. At a certain point, they needed to clear out the vaults of Shepperton Studios, and so they were going to take all of the positives. So it's the actual like the prints that they've done, but they've like the stuff that they've trimmed, basically all the cutting room floor stuff.
Yeah.
And they were going to dump that into the landfill of the M3 highway.
Oh my God.
That was currently being built. Somewhere along the way, someone accidentally put the negatives from the Wicker Man into that pile. So the actual negatives
is buried under the M3.
Yes. And so for a long time, they could not put any of this footage back because it didn't exist.
Holy shit.
Literally didn't exist. It's kind of a parallel story to the BBC used to wipe all their videotapes. So that's why there's like full seasons of original Doctor Who that don't exist anymore. And they almost wiped all record of Monty Python.
Oh, wow.
Except for the fact that America had copies. And so, like, it's the only reason Monty Python. Jesus yeah, Christ. It's crazy. Well, because back then people were like, no one's ever going to watch this again.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway, I know I'm all over the place here.
No. That's fascinating.
My point being, when I finally watched the extended version, I came away thinking the quote unquote butchered shorter cut is better.
Yeah.
It's got.
Aren't there scenes where you meet his fiance, like they're in church together or something?
That's you get a snippet of that in the theatrical. The final cut starts with them in church.
Okay.
The reason I brought this up now is because all of the stuff we're talking about is very subtextual.
Mm-hmm.
In the extended version, they lean so hard into the mystery, like giving you bits and pieces of the mystery that the first time I watched this with a friend of mine and we watched the extended cut. He hadn't seen it before.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept going like, Oh fuck. Cause I thought they were giving the whole thing away.
Got it.
Cause it was like very, unsubtle.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's, the scene in the tavern, the Green Man.
Yes.
When he's looking at the pictures and there's one picture that's missing.
Yeah.
And the landlord's like, oh yeah, it's broken. You know, who knows?
Yeah.
That scene ends with like a cartoonish shot of the landlord looking over his shoulder.
Oh, and there's like a frame.
At the empty spot.
Oh.
So it's like, okay, yeah, we get it. Okay. So like they trimmed it down and there's a lot of stuff that's kind of moved around. Like, the seduction scene with Howie and Willow in the original cut takes place much later in the movie. And
interesting.
What happens in that early spot at the Green Man is this sequence. This sequence is actually pretty good. I'm glad they put this one back in where Summer Isle shows up to the Green Man with this young guy.
Yeah.
And he's basically giving him as a sexual tribute to Willow. It's essentially like, this boy is a man, and so now I give you to the hottest woman in town.
Yeah. do they like fist bump? Like, does he do
not
like
fists,
yes.
But
well, I meant like him and Summer Isle. Oh, like, fuck yeah, bro.
No, but he goes into the thing, and it's like this whole.
It's a ritual.
It's a ritual where everybody in the Green Man is like listening to you have sex for the first time.
Yeah.
And there's a really good song in that sequence that's not in the theatrical cut.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little monologue from Christopher Lee. So I can see why I think a lot of the stuff that got cut was stuff with him in it. So I can see why he wanted a lot of that stuff back.
Yeah, that's fair.
But it's interesting because it adds things. It shifts things around a bit.
Yeah.
But I don't think it hurts. I think the shortened theatrical version is pretty tight.
It
moves pretty fast.
Yep.
And I think they managed to cut it down while also maintaining the mystery, which I think is pretty strong.
Yeah, and I like that.
Sorry,
it is.
Sorry, I hope everybody followed me for that jaunt across the atlas of my mind.
That walk across the moors, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the central mystery is done really well and is really subtle in a way I really enjoy, which is why my thing was like, this is a good cop plot. Mm-hmm. Like Howie is sent an anonymous letter that brings him to Summer Isle looking for Rowan Morrison. And he does what he should do at first, which is he just starts asking the townspeople, like, mm-hmm. "Who do you know this?" He has a picture of her and he has her name, and then he has the name of the mother. And yep. he just, you know, he's checking out all the leads. Like, he's going through the town and he's asking things. And he's noticing things, and like the movie lets you notice these things with him. Mm-hmm. Like the picture of last year's harvest is missing. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, some of the oddities around town. But it doesn't throw it in your face. And I think Howie is doing his best to, like, he does a very good job staying focused on Rowan.
Yeah.
But the behavior of the townspeople around him nearly drives him off course so many times in so many different ways, which I really love, mm-hmm. because you realize later the whole time he's being tested.
Yes. Yeah.
And not just tested in like people are lying to him or they're kind of being deliberately obtuse. They are testing him in specific ways. Mm-hmm. They want to know how dedicated is he to the law and uphold being a representative of the king.
Mm-hmm.
How dedicated is he to his purity?
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing specific things to try and drive him to distraction. And you get to see him encounter those things and react to those things and then ultimately resist. Like, he always kind of reins it back.
Yeah.
Like, he's getting frustrated with people and kind of making threats, but he never acts totally unbecoming of an officer. Do you know what I mean? He never, yeah. like, he doesn't slap the school teacher.
No.
And in a movie in 1973, I would not have been shocked if a police officer slapped a woman being obstinate towards him.
Buddy, I don't know if you remember what happens in the remake, but...
Yeah. I don't really, so that'll be fun.
Okay.
But you know, the obvious one is that he resists Willow.
Yeah.
In
that one, he turns into a cartoon wolf in his bedroom, basically. But manages to reject her.
Yeah.
Or resist, rather.
Yeah. But in this, it's, you know, the irony is that his adherence to his ideals and his sense of what's right and wrong are the things that condemn him.
Yeah.
Like, if he had been more flexible, shall we say, some might say if he had been less ethical,
mm-hmm.
he could have escaped his fate.
Well, the thing I was also thinking, too, is that if he had been, and maybe this is a argument against the good cop plot, I think you could argue he's not being that good of a cop. Because if he had focused more on the job and less on the paganism of the people.
Yeah.
I don't know. He seems pretty distracted.
Well, he is, but I think that's very on purpose. Yeah. You know, like they're taunting him.
Oh, definitely.
The
yeah.
whole time. Yeah. So it's kind of impossible for him.
It's just that I'm just saying, like, I don't mean this as a negative, but
no.
It's like, I think he's he's buying everything hook, line and sinker.
Oh, yeah, know? Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And it's they're like pre-designed to push his buttons.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, they know the kind of person they want him to be. And they're doing the things to push his buttons to make sure he's living up to that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like they're getting the measure of the man, and it's everything that they had hoped. And they can tell because they're driving him so crazy. But he never fully loses sight of the mission, though.
Yeah.
You know, like, here, ultimately, I don't really like Howie. I think he seems like an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
But I respect him. In a way.
Sure.
Because I think he has very clear convictions. And I think he stands by them pretty much until the end.
Yeah.
But I do want to talk about the very end. I don't know if we want to get there yet, but
yeah.
I have thoughts about the very, very end. But we'll get there eventually.
Yeah. Do you like Summer Isle as a foil for him?
Yes.
Yeah.
Unequivocally, yes. You've got one person who has zero charisma and seems like he's never had a normal conversation with another human being in his entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Lord Summer Isle, who is just dripping with charm.
Yes.
Like, you can see why the villagers follow Lord Summer Isle so willingly.
Yeah.
Not only do they love this religion that his family has given back to them and the prosperity that seems to have come with it, he's charming as hell.
Yeah.
Like, he's fun. He comes. He participates with them. Like, he leads the parade. He's he is the man woman.
Right.
The,
yeah.
What is it? It's the temp, the, I don't know.
I forget what they call
it.
Like, yeah.
Something tempting, tempter or seducer or something like that.
Yeah. I think there is another version of this where he doesn't do that. And it's, mm-hmm. and he understands that this religion is the placating the masses kind of thing.
Right.
I'm glad they don't go that way, because like we were saying, I do think it gives you this ambiguous kind of mm-hmm. Read on him.
Yeah.
And I think this might be Christopher Lee's best performance. It's definitely one of his best characters.
Yeah.
And it's not even like, obviously the easy way thing to point to is the final sequence mm-hmm. and a famous shot with the hands up.
Yeah, and the hair in the wind. Yeah.
But I think the first scene with him and Howie is some of the best acting I've ever seen from him, because it's
so
funny.
Funny in that. Yeah. Like, when he makes the crack about Mary being impregnated by a ghost.
Yes.
And then he says, "Please sit down, Sergeant Howie. These kinds of shocks are best absorbed with the knees bent."
That's my favorite line, like, in the whole movie.
Oh, yeah. Man, it's so good. And his delivery is so perfect.
My
And Howie looks like he wants to punch him.
Yes.
And holds it in. It's so, yeah.
My other favorite bit is when Howie is telling him about Rowan's death and how he suspects whatever. He goes, "And you expect foul play?"
Yeah.
Like, the way he says it is like, you can tell he's kind of fucking with him, but at the same time, he's kind of
absolutely
playing it like he's legitimately concerned.
Yeah. And when Howie comes at night to see the teacher essentially laid out on a bearskin rug while Summer Isle sits in his fancy boy outfit playing piano,
mm-hmm.
and he says to Howie, I understand. He says something like, aren't you supposed to be the detective?
Yes. Yeah.
Like, why would I tell you? It's really, really funny.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things about this movie that I think I didn't clock at first fully is how funny so much of it is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even one of my favorite scenes in this movie is the scene with the school headmistress and the little girls in class.
Yep.
I love that scene. Mm-hmm. I love that all the kids are so clearly enjoying this game where they get to be little shits to a grown-up.
Yes.
Like, they love it. This is so much fun for them.
Mm-hmm.
And he is just getting more and more angry with them, more and more angry with their teacher, and they're all playing it so dumb and so benign, and there's nothing he can really do about it.
Yeah.
Like, he is so impotent in the face of their defiance,
mm-hmm.
because they're really towing right up to the line.
Yeah.
Of, like, technically not doing anything wrong.
Well,
but
one of my
him crazy.
One of my favorite things about this is how everybody is in on it,
mm-hmm.
and everybody knows, as they would say in Glengarry Glen Ross, knows what the shot is.
Yeah.
But everybody fucks with him in, like, different ways.
Yes.
Like, for instance, when he gets there immediately, when he first gets there,
mm-hmm.
and he's like, "Do you know Rowan Morrison?" Like, "No, we don't know her. We had never seen that girl before."
Yep.
Well, it says daughter of May Morrison. Oh, yeah, we know May. Yeah, of course.
Slipped our mind for the minute. She
that's not
the
her
post office.
That's not her daughter, though.
Yeah.
And it's like, what?
Yeah.
Like, it's so much of that stuff where... Yeah. Like, you can never, even knowing how it all ends up, you can never quite tell who is fucking with him and who is, like, kind of slipping up.
Right, you know? And even when they're caught out in a lie, they never give it up fully.
Right,
Like when the teacher is talking to him and he's like, "Well, so she's dead." And the teacher's like, "Well, we don't use that word. She just doesn't exist anymore."
Yeah.
And he's like, "What?
Semantics, baby.
The fuck?" It's so much fun. It's Edward Woodward, right?
Yes.
Who plays Howie.
Which is a tough name to say.
Quite a tongue twister. He does such a great job.
He's great, yeah.
Like, Christopher Lee rightfully gets so much praise for this movie, but I think Woodward is a little bit of an unsung hero of this film, where he plays it so straight the whole time. and you don't like him, and you're maybe not even necessarily rooting for him, but you're not really rooting against him.
Yeah.
Because his whole mission is he thinks a little kid was murdered.
Right.
So you can't, you know what I mean? Like, the villagers are so fun, and they're having fun, and they're so charming.
Yeah.
That you like them even when they're doing weird fertility rites.
It is a strange instance in which, yeah, like I think if you haven't seen this before and you don't mm-hmm. know what the twist is, mm-hmm. there's just so much interesting stuff going on.
Yeah.
That it doesn't even matter if you like the guy.
Right.
Like at a certain point, you kind of almost forget that there's this mystery he's trying to solve.
Yeah.
Just because you're like, what is going on here?
Right, because there's so many little details. Not just little. There are mm-hmm. little and big details that are happening all around him all the time. Mm-hmm. There's all the stuff with the March Hares.
Yep.
And, you know, the whole March Hare thing is, it's like mad as a March Hare.
I've heard the expression. I don't know where it comes from or what it means.
I mean, I know there's more of a background to it. I think it has something to do with, like, mating seasons.
Oh, sure.
Like, they're all, you know, it's spring, so all the hares are crazy. But it's also, like, very much used in Through the Looking Glass.
Yeah.
So there's that sort of how he is through the looking glass. Mm-hmm. And there are just March hares everywhere. And, yeah, he goes into the cemetery, and they plant trees on everybody's graves, and they hang your umbilical cord, which has been saved from when you were born, mm-hmm. that gets hung on your tree, mm-hmm. and there's a young...
I still have mine.
Is it attached?
I wear it on my wrist.
Yeah, I got it.
It's the band for my smartwatch.
But then there's like...
It's a little sticky when I work out, but...
Should be very dry by now.
Yeah.
There's like the young mother breastfeeding her baby mm-hmm. in the cemetery, holding an egg.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's all of this stuff where as you go through it, you keep kind of trying to put it together in your head, like what all of it is doing.
Yeah.
Because it's all doing so much. And I love the montage when it's May Day and he's searched the grave. All he found was the carcass of a hare.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of out of leads.
Sorry, I don't mean to jump in, but I do love it. When he brings the hare.
He just throws it out.
Yeah, and what does she say? She says, oh, quite a lovely transmutation. I'm sure Rowan will be pleased.
Yes. But I love that, you know, he's kind of trapped on the island at this point.
Mm-hmm.
The plane won't start. He's out of leads. He still can't find this girl, but he's become convinced that they are going to sacrifice her and he needs to find her. And he's searching the village while they're having their May Day celebrations.
Yeah.
I love that montage.
That
of him going through the town and, you know, meeting the old guy who's like, that's my costume. It's the Salmon of Knowledge. Yeah. And then the girl pretending to be dead who falls out of the cupboard at him. Like, all of that shit I love.
I love when he's like, take those masks off. And they're like,
no.
But that whole sequence I love because it almost, you know, I think we talked about this maybe with Nosferatu, but there's like certain types of people that when you shoot them, you can tell they're not actors, you know, and this has that documentary feel to it.
Jaws has it too.
Yeah. This middle section, like when you see the guy taking the John Barleycorn thing out of the oven in the giant coffin-shaped bread pan, which is pretty awesome.
The little kids holding up the doll and going parading through the street yelling, we carry death out of the village.
Yeah.
I'm going to make our friends' children do that next spring.
But like all that stuff feels almost like a documentary.
Yeah.
Not so much Ingrid Pitt naked in a bathtub,
sure.
But the other stuff very much feels like that. And I do think it's funny how that kind of works with the preposterous title card at the beginning where it says, we'd like to thank Lord Summerisle for his participation.
And the people of the island for allowing us to film. Yeah.
Yeah. By the end of the movie, if you have that in the back of your mind, you're like, they okayed this?
Yeah. And the filmmakers just let them burn this guy to death?
Yeah.
I mean, he kind of sucked, but I don't think he deserved to die.
Yeah.
But I love all that. I love even you get to see the corpse where them with the missing hand that has probably become the hand Willow's of hand of glory. Yep. Mm-hmm. I love all that shit.
Yeah.
The village life, the rituals happening around the maypole and the
We forgot. Magic book.
Oh,
there's a magic book in this.
Yeah, there is.
It tells you everything you need to know about burning people alive.
Yeah.
I do remember the first time I watched this in college. As someone who was raised in a Protestant Christian household and didn't really have a lot of experience outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you go to college and you start seeing the cracks in that whole thing. I do remember watching this and going, March Hare, Rebirth, Easter Bunny. Oh my
the
God.
Girl I had like the a, egg, you're like,
I had like a Kaiser Soze moment where I was like, that explains where the Easter Bunny comes from.
Yeah, it does. It's all fertility, right, man?
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
Although I've seen people claim that's not the case, or I can't remember if they claim that the resurrection is not a Christianization of the, I don't know, whatever, for a different show.
Yeah.
So getting towards the end here, the lead up to the end, the thing that I think every time I watch this is all of the things, as I said before, all of the things that would need to go right for this to work.
Yes.
And I found myself thinking from a filmmaking standpoint, does this movie play fair and does it matter? And the scene that always sticks out to me is the Hand of Glory scene because I was thinking about it watching it this time, and I was like, okay, so assuming that what happens in the movie is exactly what they wanted to happen, do they want him to not wake up? Because they're talking about, oh, well, we don't know how this works. He might be asleep for 3 days. Or is that just a ruse?
I think it's a ruse.
And like the fact that they count on him knocking out the landlord and stealing his costume.
Well, you know, you could argue that maybe they had a backup plan.
That's true.
You know, yeah. Who's to say?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I understand what you're saying, where if you're not fully bought in the moment while you're watching this movie and you start trying to kind of analyze like, well, any step in this plan could have gone wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then where would you have been? I don't know. Maybe the villagers are like, yeah, then we killed the kid.
That's true.
You know?
I guess that is a backup, as you could always just
doesn't
kill
Lord's,
Rowan.
Lord Summerisle say towards the end, like, you know, doesn't he say like a child is good, but a certain type of adult is even better?
Yes.
Yeah.
But like it's so fun when they list off all the things. It's like, no, we got one guy that's all of these things.
Yeah.
Once in a lifetime. Once in a lifetime do we get the representative of the king who the king for a day, who comes here under his own free will, who's also a virgin and also a fool.
I think the fool part goes along with the king for a day.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Probably the virgin part is the hard part.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Finding an adult man who's the representative of the king and a virgin.
Yeah. Those kings like to get it on. It's funny watching it again. I watched some of the extended cut and seeing the parts with the other cop at the beginning. In my head, I was like, for some reason, I feel like this other cop is from Summer Isle or something like that. Because I was thinking, like, well, how else would they know this much about this guy?
Oh, maybe.
But I think that might actually be something they do in the remake.
Yeah, I think so.
I can't 100% remember.
Yeah, we'll get to it.
Yeah.
Do you have sympathies in this movie with one side or the other? Like, who do you feel like is anybody in this the good guy? Do the good guys win? Do the bad guys win?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think that they present Howie as unlikable enough that obviously, you know, I guess you never want to see somebody killed most of the time, but he's just not it's not, you're not exactly, like you said, not exactly rooting for him to win.
Right.
And I think the other trick of this movie is once they drop the hammer on you,
mm-hmm.
you are just like along for the ride.
Yeah.
Like you're along for the ride for most of this movie, but yeah. as things start to come together, once they reveal what is actually going on,
mm-hmm.
you just kind of have no choice but to just ride to the end.
Yeah. And I think there's a good, like you said, when they drop the hammer, perfect mm-hmm. expression for this. When that turn happens, you start to see the characters who were otherwise kind of quirky and entertaining and charming in mm-hmm. a different light.
Yeah.
Like, especially there's at the end when the Wicker Man is burning and they show all the villagers in a ring around it, watching it burn and listening to Howie scream.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the one guy who was the groundskeeper around the cemetery who helped him excavate the coffin. And he looks fucking thrilled. He's having the most fun he's ever had in his whole life.
Yes.
And it just makes everybody, it twists everyone from kind of fun and entertaining to very sinister.
And it's
very quickly.
The thing that's so great about it too is it's not like they do in most movies now where once you find out there's a sinister plot,
mm-hmm.
everybody in the town becomes like sinister townspeople.
Yeah, everybody's like head tilted down looking up under their eyebrows, Jack Torrance style.
Everybody in Summer Isle is reacting like it's the end of The Sting. Where it's like they pulled it off.
Yeah,
they did it. Like
they're
everybody's
all like
celebrating.
Exciting. Yeah, they tried to do this thing and it worked.
Yeah.
And now they're gonna get to have their ceremony and it's gonna fix everything and it's gonna be great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, as far as does the good guy win, do the bad guy win? I think they cover that in how he yells to Summer Isle.
Mm.
Because I think you kind of go into the end going like, this is not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just going to keep going. Like they're coming for you next time.
Yeah.
So I think there's a kind of thing where it's like, yeah, they killed this guy, but they think they won, but they've only, you know, it's a stopgap kind of thing.
Yeah. My other question is,
mm-hmm.
is Howie, what do you think about Howie at the end as he's in the Wicker Man and facing his own death?
He doesn't try very hard to get out of there.
Yeah, he really doesn't.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I see a lot, like I've seen a lot of stuff where people argue that he embraces his death because it gives him a martyr's death.
I was thinking that, but I don't really know if the text supports that so much.
I don't really,
because he seems pretty freaked out by it.
Yeah. He seems, if anything, kind of shaken in his faith. Like, not saying he's abandoned it in the last moments, but his final coherent prayer, he's begging God not to really save his life, but to save his soul, because he is dying unshriven.
Yes.
Which means he has not had the opportunity to confess.
Oh, is that what that means?
Yeah.
I just assumed it was, you know, general purity.
No. He is saying, like, he's not getting an opportunity to confess his sins before death. He's not getting last rites.
Okay, sure.
So, you know, in more strict interpretations of Christianity, you don't go to heaven then.
Yeah.
Maybe you go to purgatory.
Okay.
If you're lucky.
Yeah.
But, you know, the unforgiven don't go to heaven. So he's not...
I've heard the song. I know.
Yeah. He's not in sort of the ideal position. And
yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. And I would even argue that he's kind of aware he's not dying because of his faith.
Yes.
Like, martyrs are killed because they are Christian.
Yes.
He's not. He's just the right type of guy. The only way his religion really played into it is it was the value that kept him from having sex before marriage.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I think his death is really tragic in a double way when you look at it like that. Like, not only is he not getting rescued, he's also not really getting this religious godly death that he would value.
He doesn't exactly go out like Joan of Arc, you know?
Well,
I mean, in a technical sense he does, but but you know what I mean? Like, it's not like that final prayer is like the end of Fire Walk With Me when she sees the angel and it's like, oh, the, you know,
I am going to be saved. Yes. Yeah. There's no bright light from above. There's no sign. There's nothing.
And as you're saying that, that plea belies that he is afraid that he won't be going to heaven. That this is not the best way for him to go.
Right. Which is a really interesting thing in the face of maybe not Summer Isle, but the rest of the villagers, their absolute belief that this is going to work.
Yeah.
Like, you can question if Summer Isle really believes it or not, but I think the villagers do.
Yes,
I think they fully believe it. And that's why there's that sense of revelry and relief at the end. Mm-hmm. Like, we did it. It's all going to work now. Their faith is actually the more, as much as they're sort of more relaxed about so many things, their faith is the more zealous one.
Yeah.
You know, they're more absolutist in their belief than he is.
Yeah, because there's a very particular set of events that need to occur. And they got to hit a hole in one here at the end.
Yeah.
That's the only chance that they have as far as they're concerned. What was I going to say? So, one of the fun things is that Edward Woodward, they wrote, so the weather was such a problem that they kind of had to go and shoot stuff when they could and wait for, because they shot it in November.
Ooh.
Yeah. So that final sequence, everybody is very cold.
Huh.
And they said, Edward Woodward said that final speech, they didn't have it all locked in. Mm. And then they were like, okay, we got to shoot this tomorrow. And so he didn't have time to learn it. Mm. And so they ended up getting gigantic cue cards for him. So he's in the thing this thing. A little bit it was improv, but he's like, he's got these giant cue cards in front of him while he's screaming it.
It's just one that they keep holding up, the one that says, oh, Lord, oh, Lord, Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ.
Well, it's funny because I watching it now is like, this kind of almost feels like it is improv because of the way he kind of like turns into this prophet.
Yeah,
because he's just a guy. And then he starts talking about, like, and ye shall all die. And
he's like,
operatic and
he's also
revelatory.
Like, imitating the cadence of the Bible,
though. Yes.
Like, it's sort of like he's trying to borrow authority from it.
Yeah.
Like, he thinks if he says it, you know, maybe not intentionally, but part of his brain thinks, if I say it this way in this big biblical tone, then it's going to be like the dramatic moment in moments in the Bible where either God or an angel comes down or the pagans hear and then they know and then they realize I'm right and they'll let me go. Like he I think he kind of thinks he can create a big biblical moment where he escapes somehow.
Well, either way, good on Howie for recognizing the moment and going very theatrical with it, because I feel like I would ideally would do that, but I'd probably just not think of anything good to say.
I would just honestly be pissing myself and crying. That would be it.
You're trying to knock that thing over.
So
this final sequence, obviously, they set the Wicker Man on fire.
They sing a great song.
Yes, which that song is one of the... I didn't look this up. I'm just doing this from my brain. So I apologize if I'm wrong. But it's one of the oldest Western pieces of music. Something like that. And I only know that because it's actually the first track on the Richard Thompson album, 1,000 Years of Popular Music.
Oh, wow.
And when I was listening, when I put that album on and that was the first thing he sang, I was like, what? Why is he doing the Wicker Man song? But it's one of those songs where it's like, it's a Celtic song or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I apologize for not knowing the details.
Yeah. That's awesome.
But yeah, the first time I saw this was on a small TV in my dorm room, and it was effective enough then.
Yeah.
A few years ago, I got to see this at the Coolidge, which has this massive, massive screen. And I went with our friend Jim and his wife, and the two of us literally at the end of the movie, like, didn't move for a couple beats.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because it was unbelievable. Like, if you ever get the chance, anybody, to see this movie in the theater, go see it, because that final sequence is absolutely incredible.
Yeah. Can you think of a worse way to die?
Cholera sounds pretty bad.
Yeah.
Because that's, you just like shit yourself to death.
Yeah.
Which is essentially how I assume I'm going to go anyway.
I do feel like dying via Wicker Man, though, is pretty fucking bad.
It's not great.
Because, like, you are towards the top.
Yeah.
And so you get to hear all the animals screaming.
Yeah, you're probably hungry because it smells like roast duck and stuff.
Or you're the opposite of hungry. But you're just hearing all of the screaming and sounds of dying animals beneath you as the fire gets closer. And then I guess, do you just hope you die of smoke inhalation first?
I guess.
You know, because the other options are you burn to death.
Mm-hmm.
Or
never good.
Or you mostly burn and you get a bunch of smoke inhalation, but then the Wicker Man itself collapses and then you have to hope that it crushes you.
Yeah.
And then if it doesn't, what do they have to just like come over and finish you off while you like choke and burn and are crushed? Like, that's pretty rough, right? That's
a
pretty awful way to go.
Yeah.
Just putting it out there. I think that's part of the horror of this movie. Is that if you put yourself in Howie's position at the end there, helpless and just feeling it get hotter and hotter and hotter and hearing the animals get louder and louder.
Where pretty, most pretty people bad. Would stop at burned alive in a giant effigy, I appreciate that you've really dug into the minutiae.
Gamed it out, yeah. I mean, there are some possibilities and none of them are good. Just saying.
You have to wait until the fire burns the right beam, and then you kick your way out.
But
then
you
jump.
Are you too high up?
Yeah,
you're too high up, and you just, you know,
break your legs.
Yeah, and then they come and they kill you anyway. Yeah, or they just throw you back in the fire.
Yeah, there's really, I mean, that's one of the great things about the ending is that it is one of the few endings where it's like checkmate. Like,
yeah,
it's total checkmate.
Right.
There's no way out of this.
I think that's part of the reason why Howie doesn't fight.
Yeah.
Is he's got an entire island's worth of people.
Yeah.
Who were very determined to see him die. And they're not even determined to see him die in sort of a malicious way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, they're not even like, there's nothing personal. They're not mad at him. Like, he didn't do anything wrong to them.
Yeah.
In fact, they're just kind of excited. They're like super happy to see him die.
I also love the head fake they do where he tries to escape with Rowan.
Yes.
And they start playing that like funky 70s yes, chase music.
Yes, yes.
And then it's all just part of the plan again. And it's just like, yeah, man.
And but he gets his hero moment.
Yeah.
You know, he thinks, I'm doing it. I'm the best cop ever. I found her. I'm going to save her. I'm going to get this little girl out of here. I'm going to come home and be a hero.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have the entire army invade this island. Like,
I don't know. Even there, though, I don't know how he thinks he's going to get out of there. Because at this point, he knows the whole island is in on it.
Mm-hmm.
His plane's broken.
Yeah.
Where's he going to go?
Steal a boat.
Yeah, I guess.
I don't know. Just, you know, at that point, I think he's already to the end of knowing he's alone.
Yes.
You know, and he's desperate. But I think it really is the realization that Rowan is not in danger and Rowan was in on it, too.
Mm-hmm.
Is the thing that kind of breaks him at the end.
That's my favorite bit of acting from him.
Yeah.
Is when the reveal happens and he just kind of goes into like a fugue state.
Yeah. Yeah. He's like,
until he sees the Wicker Man.
Yes.
And then delivers the greatest line reading of, "Oh God, oh Jesus Christ," ever put on film.
So good. Yeah. I could talk about this movie all night.
Yeah.
I fucking love this movie. Yeah. Yeah.
Just rounding it out though.
Hmm.
The music is done by a guy named Paul Giovanni. And I believe his band called Magnet.
Hmm.
I could be wrong, but that's in my brain for some reason.
Okay.
Do you like the music in this? Because I feel like people could go either way.
When I first saw this movie, I was like, this music is dumb. And the more I watch this movie, the more I love the music.
Yeah.
And I just love what this film does tonally.
Mm.
Where you're seeing the island and it is so idyllic and you have this kind of corny, folksy music over it. And then it turns into, now we're murdering a guy in a giant wicker statue.
Right, yeah.
I, yeah, I really enjoy it.
Yeah, I do too. It's it again, if you're not expecting it, it kind of catches mm-hmm. you off guard.
Mm-hmm.
But it is so, I don't think any of it feels out of place.
Yeah.
The only one that feels like this feels like a musical mm-hmm. number mm-hmm. is the one with Willow. Because yeah. the rest yeah. of them have, I can't remember if it's diegetic or non-diegetic is the one where it's actually happening in the movie.
I think diegetic is it's happening in the movie. Okay. Like if you hear a guitar, someone's playing a guitar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the only one that has non-diegetic music. The rest of them, it's like the band is playing.
Right. And people like in the tavern yeah. have a fiddle, or the girls are chanting yeah. as they jump over the fire.
I'm assuming they do that with the Mayday, with the Maypole song as well.
Yeah.
Could be wrong, but.
Yeah. There was definitely a kid with a.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Because they do that kind of close up of the.
I love it.
But yeah, but even that, it doesn't really, you know, there's some mysticalness built into the Willow scene anyway. So.
Yeah.
Speaking of her boyfriend at the time, Rod Stewart, not happy with that scene. Tried to get the movie shut down when he found out about it.
Oh, but. Fuck off, Rod Stewart.
Yeah, she dated Peter Sellers for a long time, too.
Probably better. Interesting. Better than Rod
she's
Stewart.
One, she's like, from the very little I know about her personal life, she's got one of those like Marilyn Monroe personal lives where it's like, she was married to Eugene O'Neill and Joe mm-hmm. DiMaggio.
Yeah. When you go through the list and you're like, really? Is it
Eugene O'Neill? I can't remember which playwright.
I think it was. Tennessee now that you're Williams saying, now that you said Eugene O'Neill, it's all I can think. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, who knows? Yeah, I really love the music. This is one of those movies that like, I kind of appreciate that it's a little bit difficult still to find because as we were, you know, you watched it on Tubi.
Yep.
When I have it on DVD, but I wanted to watch like an HD copy. So I wanted to see what they had on streaming.
Yeah.
They had all three versions in three different places.
Jesus.
And which, whatever.
Yeah.
But, like this is the perfect kind of movie that deserves its cult status.
Yes.
And lives up to it, I think.
Yeah.
You know, this is one where, if you find it and you put it on, you're going to be like, I don't know what this is, but it feels important.
Yeah. It is an interesting movie in so many ways, but I never know who to recommend this one to.
Yes.
Because there are people I would have thought would like it, and they really don't.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are people who don't typically like this kind of thing. And then they watch The Wicker Man, and they're like, fuck yeah, The Wicker Man. I'm like, yeah. What? Like, I can't get a... it's just such a unique movie, I guess, that it hits different people in different ways. So it makes it really hard to say, oh, well, if you like this movie, you should watch The Wicker Man.
Yeah.
Like, there aren't many things you can directly compare it to get kind of a good read on what the core audience is.
Yeah. I think I thought about this recently. I think that the closest I have seen to generating the same kind of feeling or the same kind of style as The Wicker Man that I've seen recently anyway is Sinners. Because I think Sinners is as much of a folk horror movie as this is.
Yeah.
And the music is a big part of Sinners. And it's, I think that's the closest modern analog I can think of.
That's an interesting comparison.
Because, I mean, you could go to like Midsummer, obviously, or anything that involves somebody getting burned to death at the end by a cult. Right. And it's like, oh, it's just like The Wicker Man.
Yeah.
Midsummer's pretty close.
Midsummer's pretty close, but even then it's close, but it's not.
Midsummer is close if instead of singing, you had grief wailing.
Yeah. But there is still some singing in that one, if I remember correctly.
I'm sure there is. I can't directly remember. It's been a while. But this is number 81, I believe, on our list.
Mm.
How do you feel about that?
I would put this closer to the top end of, I don't know exactly where I would put it. I'd probably break top 25 at least.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah.
Would you call it a horror movie?
I would.
Yeah.
I would. I don't know why I feel so strongly about this one, where it is sort of, there are probably other movies that we've covered that I've been more on the fence about that other people would be much more confident is a horror movie than this.
Mm-hmm.
I think for me, it's the themes in it about, you know, who and what is an outsider, yeah, and belief and all of that stuff, and the ultimate sort of futility of Howie's death. Like, he's dying for these people's beliefs, but it's probably not going to do anything, and this cycle might just continue on and on and on.
Yeah.
It's pretty horrifying.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I would probably put it higher as well. Yeah, top 25. Yeah. It's funny doing this, though, because it's like every time I say that, I'm like, this is about 50 movies in my top 25 right at this point.
I feel the same way, but it's difficult where there's one, you know, especially like this is a movie that is over 50 years old, mm-hmm, and it was almost kind of lost to history,
yeah,
repeatedly.
It's a bit of a miracle that it still exists.
And it has had, I think, a profound effect on the genre of horror.
Oh, yeah.
There are plenty of directors and people who clearly have taken inspiration from, yeah, this movie.
And I will say, I'm an easy mark when it comes to The Wicker Man.
Mm.
So, like, if your movie grazes The Wicker Man, I'm like, yeah, nice. It's just like The Wicker Man. Sick.
Probably me too.
Yeah.
Yeah, to be honest.
But yeah, I think that's going to do it for... Oh, I did want to mention that for years, I was excited because Robin Hardy talked about doing not a sequel, but a sort of like spiritual sequel called The Wicker Tree.
Hmm.
Which he eventually did.
Okay.
And I eventually watched.
Uh-oh.
And it is real bad.
Oh.
Yeah. It's one of those things where it's like, oh, all of the stuff that was kind of subtextual about the original is now just the text and not well-written text.
Yeah.
So avoid that, even though, unfortunately, Christopher Lee does make an appearance in it. It's like one of the last things he did, I think.
Oh.
Not great.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's going to do it for our coverage of the original Wicker Man.
Mm-hmm.
If you'd like to help support the show or listen to what we're going to say about the remake, head over to patreon.com/thepenskyfile. You can follow us down our road of remakes and reboots. And next week or next time on this show, we're going to be doing our regularly scheduled choice, which is number 154, Tremors.
Yeah.
Very similar to the Wicker Man. So... thank you guys for listening. Thank you, Amanda.
Thank you, Clay, and may you always be protected by the ejaculation of serpents.
Yeah, well, you know. I do want to end with a quote from Anthony Schaefer, which I thought was very appropriate given what we're doing on Patreon, which is, this business is run mostly by zombies that are overpaid and are so timid that all they can do is reproduce something that has already been done a trillion times. So with that being said, we'll see you over on Patreon for the Wicker Man remake. Thanks, everybody. See you later.
Good night, everyone.